good morning. I know you thought you were done having to listen to me for a while in class, but Tom's preaching at Livingston, so you're stuck with me again. What we're going to do today is go through the handout that he gave out on Wednesday. I hope you've had time to look at it and to think of about some of these things, at least. So we're not doing it too cold this morning. If you have that handout, go ahead and pull that out. I think I saw some on the back table. If you don't have one, you want to flag somebody down, Brian's getting up. If you raise a hand or something, if you don't have one. All right. Well, we're in this class on how to study. And I wasn't here Wednesday. I was speaking in Wesley Chapel, and so I didn't get the context of this, at least the way that he presented it. But basically what we're talking about is context, literary context in particular, the surrounding verses and ideas, and how it shapes what a passage means. And there's a list on these two pages, front and back, I guess probably is what you have, of passages that are used sometimes to say something that they may not necessarily say when you consider the larger surrounding context. And that's basically all I'm going to say by way of introduction. We're going to go through these and talk about the questions that he asked. On most of them, I'll have something of a follow-up question to ask if we don't get to it in the course of discussion. So go ahead and turn to Romans 14. We'll read both of these passages to start and then deal with the question that follows. Romans chapter 14 and verse 23. Romans chapter 14 and verse 23, whoever has doubts is condemned if he eats, because the eating is not from faith, for whatever does not proceed from faith is sin. And then back in chapter 10 and verse 17, perhaps a more familiar verse, so faith comes from hearing and hearing through the word of Christ. So the question that we have is in Romans 14, 23, we read that whatever is not of faith is sin. And in Romans 10, 17, we read that faith cometh by hearing and hearing by the word of God. Therefore, some reason that these two verses prove that whatever is not from the Bible is sinful. Why is this not a valid argument? Shane. Okay.
It's not necessarily talking about biblical faith as far as faith in God. So the faith that comes by hearing is a different faith. So they don't mean the same thing.
Okay. Any other thoughts, Barry?
Well, sometimes when we take these words out of their context, and there's a word that has a bigger meaning, like whatever, which could expand out to almost anything, we tend to want to give it that kind of meaning instead of the meaning of the real context that whatever is relating to. You know what I mean by that?
Okay, so we've got two different directions now. One is that faith means different things in these two different contexts, and one is the word whatever in the context of Romans 14. Whatever is not of faith is sin. Well, does whatever mean whatever in this big, broad, general sense, or does it mean a narrowed sense of what is being discussed in this context, and whatever within this context is not of faith is sin? Okay, and those two ideas kind of dovetail nicely together and clarify what's going on. Any other ideas on this first one? Yeah, Jeremy?
Seem to actually answer the argument that whatever is not of faith is sin, whatever you don't hear in the Bible is sinful or not worth anything. But Paul is saying in Romans 14, if you have this conviction, and it might not be based on the Word of God, but it's a personal conviction, you're going to violate your conscience by engaging in this, then you hold that conviction. And so Paul seems to be answering the argument that's being made.
Okay. Sure.
Specifically, if you look at the first part of verse 23 and
says that whoever has doubts is condemned if he eats, because the eating is not from faith. That, you know, is I don't know how you could take that faith and make it a, you know, biblical faith, that this, you know, you're doubting, you're not eating of God's word. You know, it's more of the context of your conviction, your personal conviction. It's okay for me to eat this myself, but if I see someone else eating something that I don't think I should be eating, and if I go ahead and eat that, then I've violated my conscience, and therefore it's not. I don't have faith in what I'm doing.
Yeah, maybe that's a good way of kind of trying to wrap this first question up a little bit, because if we get stuck here too long, we won't make any progress at all. What is the faith within the context? What is the larger context of each of these passages in helping us clarify what Paul is talking about? What is being discussed in Romans 10 in the verses that lead up to and follow verse 17? Okay.
So it's responding in faith to the message of salvation.
Okay.
Verse 22 talks about the faith that you have keep between yourself and God. So if faith almost becomes like a shorthand in Romans 14 of saying, it's your understanding of God's will for your life, and you demonstrate your trust in God by being true to your own understanding. Whether your understanding is correct or maybe flawed, that you're demonstrating your trust in God by So it does seem to be talking about something different.
Yeah, I mean, Romans 10 is this big kind of broad salvation context. And Romans 14 is a much more narrow personal preference and conviction related to food context. And so those, I think, contexts make it pretty clear that Paul's not talking about the same thing in both of those passages. All right, well, we need to keep moving. So the second one, in Hebrews 2:12, we read, "In the midst of the church, I will sing thy praise." What does this passage teach about using instrumental music in the worship of a local congregational assembly? Nothing? Anyone have a different answer? This is one of those passages, I don't know that I've heard it. Tom was telling me that he's heard people use this passage to make that argument. And I think the answer is pretty simply nothing. There's nothing about a congregational context in Hebrews 2 at all. The congregation, or the church that is being spoken of, is the group of God's people. Shane? Yeah, that's the way it does seem to be cited. I mean, what leads up to it, verse 11, this is why he's not ashamed to call them brothers, and then I will tell of your name to my brothers. And that's the kind of the proof for Jesus not being ashamed to call them brothers. Also, this quote, and this is a quote from the Old Testament, it's coming out of Psalm 22, which is a very messianic psalm, as I'm sure you're well aware, which puts the original quote in even a further back context and gives you an idea of what this church, this congregation, this assembly that is being talked about in Hebrews 2 is, which is just kind of a generic way of talking about God's people. In Psalm 22, probably the original context would have even more to do with going to the temple and praising God there, fulfilling some kind of vow. This is one of those laments. We've talked a little bit about laments recently here, but very often those laments end with a vow of praise where they're going to go to the temple and fulfill a vow of some sort in terms of God taking care of them in the midst of this situation. So yeah, I don't want to get too bogged down on that one. I think that's a pretty obvious one. But yeah, any last comments, Barry?
Well, a lot of people will look to David and his use of instruments in praise to God as their proof text for using instrumental music. So if this is a quote that's coming from David and it's being used in the New Testament, they kind of use that connection between David and the New Testament to justify the use of instruments because he used them.
I could see someone trying to make that argument. I don't know how much water that holds. Obviously, that's not the context of Hebrews 2 either. My understanding is that primarily when this text is used in regard to what it teaches about instrumental music, it's Church of Christ preachers using it to say you don't use instrumental music, and I just don't know what Hebrews 2 is, how that even relates to that. So, all right, well, while we're in Psalm 22, let's go ahead and jump down to number 6, and then we'll come back to number 3. Number 6, in Psalm 22:1, we read, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? In the context of Psalm 22, why is it suspect to affirm that the speaker believes that God has forsaken or abandoned him? Did anyone have any thoughts on this one? Shane. Okay.
And all of this, so it almost seems like it's more of Goethe's language of, I'm suffering. If someone looked at me, they might think that God has forsaken me because I'm in such a miserable state.
Okay. Other thoughts? Brother Winton?
Elsweller says that Jesus took all our sins on himself.
Okay.
And since he was full of sin, God could not be in his presence at that moment.
Okay.
Tom disagrees with me there.
That's you're a step ahead of me at this point. We're not to Jesus yet. Jesus does quote this verse, and there is something to think about in regard to that. But when this psalm was originally written, for the first 1,000 years or whatever, after it was written, before Jesus ever said it, what did it mean? Is the question that I'm on at this point. With that kind of context in mind, any other ideas on this? Yeah, Tim?
It seems like I would just read the first verse or a couple of verses.
Okay. Anything else?
Well, if he genuinely believed God had completely forsaken him, why would he write this song?
Okay. What's the point of calling out to God?
When it comes to a prayer, help me not far. Help me. Well, if he genuinely believed that he was utterly forsaken, then the author would have no reason to pray to God at all, but he does. So he certainly
yeah, and that idea of prayer really runs through the whole thing. I mean, verse 2, I cry by day, but you do not answer, and by night, but I find no rest. And so it starts with, I'm continually calling out to you, and it seems as if you don't answer me, but I'm continually calling out to you. And then verse 11 that you mentioned, be not far from me, for trouble is near. Verse 19, you, O Lord, do not be far off. 20, deliver my soul from the sword. And then kind of this vow of praise, I'll tell your name to my brothers in the midst of the congregation. I'll praise you in verse 22. And then in the verse that Tim mentioned in verse 24 may be the most significant of all. And that is the conclusion that he comes to ultimately is exactly the opposite of verse 1. Verse 1 is, God, it sure seems like you have forsaken me. But when he gets to verse 24, what he says is, he has not despised or abhorred the affliction of the afflicted, and he has not hidden his face from him, but he has heard when he cries to him. And so what the larger picture of Psalm 22 seems to be saying is that I really feel as if God has forsaken me. I feel as if God is not listening to me. It seems to me that this is the case. But as I work my way through this grief and through this situation, whatever it may be, I come to realize that God has not forsaken me. As much as it might have seemed that way to me at the time, God has not forsaken me. God has not left me all alone. God has been there with me all along. And that seems to be the larger picture of Psalm 22, at least in my understanding of it. Shane?
Well, could this be sort of like people today use the phrase unanswered prayers, which I always, I kind of chuckle at because, just because God didn't give you what you asked for doesn't mean it wasn't an answered prayer. And
right.
My answer to them is, well, God's answer may have been no, mm-hmm. but it's still an answer to the prayer. So maybe, as the writer is praying for help, God hasn't given it to him yet because he hasn't suffered to the point where God, if God's trying to teach this person or help them grow, we can ask for relief, but if God doesn't think we're ready yet, he may not grant that relief just yet. And so, we might view that as an unanswered prayer, but God's just saying not yet.
Yeah, and kind of another side of that issue of, God answers all prayer, sometimes it's yes, sometimes it's no. The other way of looking at that is if we're praying properly and all of our prayers and all of our life is ultimately rooted in God being glorified and God's will being done, then the answer is always yes. We just might not understand why yes means no to us, but it's still ultimately in the larger sense for His glory and His will. And so the answer is the same. But yeah, that could be part of what's going on here. From the human perspective, it sure seems like the answer is no, that God is not listening. But ultimately, he comes to that conclusion that God has not forsaken him. After all, it just really seemed to him like he had. And we've probably all been in that kind of emotional situation, or if we haven't, we probably will be at some point, where it sure seems like God isn't listening to a thing that you say. And you have those moments of doubt and despair and feeling forsaken. But ultimately what you find in this and in other laments as well is that as much as it seems that way, God has not. And we saw that when we were going through Lamentations, right? It's, there's all of these terrible situations, but in the middle of it is great is your faithfulness. God is still doing what God does, and he can still be trusted. Barry? All right, well, that leads me then to the kind of the follow-up question I have on this that Brother Winton got us going in the direction of already, and that is, if the larger picture of this psalm is that he has not been forsaken, the psalmist, does that have any implication on Jesus' words when he quotes this psalm? And kind of the typical traditional position that Brother Winton expressed for us makes a whole lot of sense, and that is that Jesus takes on the sins of the world, and God is a holy God, and he cannot be in contact with sin, and so he forsakes Jesus at this point. And this is the point on the cross where man's sins are put on Jesus, and God forsakes him, and he says this. And I certainly have no problem with that understanding. I don't want to start a debate in class or anything, obviously. I just want you to think through what, if any, implications might there be from a full context understanding of Psalm 22 as it relates to Jesus. Any thoughts?
Looking at him on the cross, he would sort of be the same situation.
Okay. Okay, so to look at him is to see a forsaken man, just as the psalmist feels forsaken.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. And that ultimately, you know, regardless of how you understand those words on Jesus' lips in particular, the final answer is clearly Jesus is not forsaken by God, right? I mean, regardless of what you think about Jesus saying these words on the cross, Jesus wasn't forsaken by God in the end. He might have been forsaken by him temporarily in that situation, as it has been traditionally understood, but in the end, God raises him from the dead. So, I mean, that's the end of the story no matter what. So the larger picture is still there, regardless of how you understand that one particular quote. One question that I think is fair to ask is, if Jesus meant, God has not forsaken me, when he said, why have you forsaken me, why didn't he quote verse 24 instead of quoting verse 1? That's a fair question to ask, Shane.
Well, I think, again, if you follow the context of the psalm, it appears that you have forsaken me. Everyone that looks upon me, just like he says in the psalm, people, you know, make faces at me. They mocked me. And all this happened to Jesus, but by the end of the psalm, as you already stated, God has not forsaken the writer of the psalm. God really didn't forsake Jesus. He was saved. God was faithful. God did exactly what he said he was going to do. So, I mean, it follows, Jesus' crucifixion follows the psalm quite, you know, nicely.
Okay. Charlie?
Well, also, back when Jesus was quoting it, we didn't have our perfect and, you know, correctly placed chapter division. So, this could have been a way to, because it was all in our old communication world, this could have been a way to say, hey, think of this.
Turn in your Bibles to Psalm 22.
Right.
Yeah, that's kind of the idea of what he's saying there. And we do know that the Hebrews would identify books of the Bible by the first words of the Bible. That was the name of that book, was in the beginning, was the name of the book of Genesis. And with Psalms, they would identify them by the beginning of the Psalm. And Jesus is, you know, he's hanging on a cross where you die by suffocation. And crucified people don't waste words. So he's not going to quote the entire psalm. What he would do, if what he's doing is to try to draw their attention to the entire psalm, what he would do is quote the first verse. And then it's kind of, you know, first of all, that fits the situation he's currently in, like Shane was saying. Second of all, that draws their attention to the entire psalm. And obviously, it's not just verse 1 that's about Jesus on the cross. You keep reading, the whole psalm is about Jesus on the cross. And so, you know, whether you see verse 24 being fulfilled only in the resurrection or being fulfilled even as Jesus is on the cross, that's really the question. It's fulfilled either way. Mark?
That's what I was going to say.
Okay.
It reminded the Jewish readers, this is where you go. The whole story, ultimately whether you believe he was forsaken temporarily or not at all, it's sort of a rhetorical question.
Yeah.
This happened to me so that you could be glorified.
Right.
And that's a struggle that I have to believe in the moment, that that's why God is allowing this to happen. But if it could ever be proven, it would be at the cross. Say, well, if it could happen for Jesus to show that God can be glorified even in that, then anything I go through could allow God to be glorified in the end.
Greg?
That's what I was going to say. Jesus.
Okay.
In all manner we were, he suffered in all ways that man suffered.
All right.
All
right. So you said what Mark said. Mark said what Charlie said. Anyone want to say what Greg said? No? Okay. And yeah, Shane.
I'll just throw one more thing in. Yeah. Jesus had asked to be relieved of this cup, and God, you know, said it was his will that he go through with it. So that even adds more to the context of, you know, I've asked and you haven't listened. That type of thought. Jesus didn't want to go to the cross. He went willingly.
Yeah. All right. Anything else on that one before we move on? All right. Well, let's stay on the back page since you're there. Number 5. We'll just go backwards a little bit. Numbers are arbitrary, right? We're still in the Psalms. I'll use that as my my excuse. Number five, in Psalm 111, verse 9, we read that holy and reverend is his name, referring to God. Some cite this passage to prove that you should not call any man by the title of reverend. Why is this interpretation suspect? I imagine most of you have heard that at least at some point in your life. I know I heard it several times in my life growing up. The Bible only uses the word reverend once, and it's of God. Therefore, we should not use it of any man. Something along those lines is typically the way that I've heard it. Shane?
I don't know if this is the answer, but what I discovered looking at some of other translations is they don't use the word reverend, they use the word awesome.
Okay.
Okay,
so the word in some translations, the word that's behind the English word reverend in the King James Version is the what that's quoted from. In some translations, it's not translated reverend. Maybe that gives you another idea that's kind of corollary to that. Anybody? Okay, well, yeah. You go through all the English translations and find all the words that are translated that way. Great, perhaps, maybe. And then we have a long list of words you shouldn't call people now because you've looked at all the translations. Well, Jeremy, go ahead.
Well, but seriously, there are a lot of descriptive phrases, a lot of adjectives used to describe God in the Psalm. And some of them, like righteous and merciful and faithful, those are adjectives used to describe man in different parts of the Bible. And so it's not the... It's not that there's something wrong with... I think all of these can be used to describe men in some ways, but not in the way that it's used to describe God.
Okay.
And so, the point is there's... God is more holy and reverend than, that is his name, that is who he is. But that doesn't mean that those qualities can't be present in men to a lesser degree. Certainly, hopefully, if we're trying to be like God, we want to have those qualities of holiness about us.
Okay, so you've got one way of looking at it is to look at the character traits of God and the ways that God is described, and the reality that much of those same ways that God is described, people are described in those ways as well, but to a lesser degree. And so it may be okay to use some of those words to describe man. The question is which ones and to what degree is perhaps one way of looking at it. Barry?
Just as Jesus told the people, call no man father.
Okay. Okay, so context comes up again. Brother Winton?
John just says, call no man father.
Yeah. You've got that kind of idea of, a very clear, definitive, restrictive statement that we look at and say, well, obviously that's not what that means. And, why do we say that? Well, because of the context. It makes it pretty clear that that's what's going on. Shane? Okay. Adam?
Well, maybe you shouldn't call him reverend, but this particular argument is poor. Because just from this passage, it also says his name is holy. We know from elsewhere that God says, you shall be holy as I am.
Okay.
So that's argument one. That's what Jerry is saying. Argument two is that Jesus is a man. And so are you saying that call Jesus...
Okay. One more thing that no one has mentioned that is, I think, probably the strongest argument against the kind of the traditional argument that you shouldn't call anybody reverend because this is the only place it appears in the Bible, is that really what the argument comes down to is this is the only place the word reverend is shows up in the King James Version in English. The Hebrew word that is translated reverend in this passage is used dozens and dozens of times in the Old Testament. It's used a lot. And you know who it's used of in addition to God? People. It's the word that's very often translated afraid, or in the verb form to fear somebody, is the same word. And so it's used all over the place in the Old Testament. It's used of God and it's used of people. And so that's the problem with the argument, is that you're hinging the entire argument on a Hebrew words translation in one particular version. And, you know, you have to understand, as we all do, the Bible's translated. And so if we're going to make an argument from a word study, the word is only used this way, we need to make sure that we have all the instances of how that word is used, not just all the instances of how it's used in one particular translation into English. So that's the danger of that kind of argument. And it's not to say that argument can't ever be made. We just need to be very careful when we make that kind of argument because of the translation factor. Then you add to that the points that Jeremy made and Adam made and Shane and Barry made as well, and it becomes pretty obvious that this is something of a flawed kind of argument. Now, that said, how might you argue? I think we would all agree that one person in a church should not be elevated above other people in the church to a higher level as if he is a greater kind of person. How might you make that argument if verses like this and the one in John don't make that argument? Barry?
I would go back to what Shane said about giving titles to people. And, you know, we do see instances of that throughout, where Jesus condemns them for the titles that they've given to themselves and each other and things like that. Why are you calling me Reverend? Why are you calling me Rabbi? Why are you calling me this? Or that or the other thing?
Okay.
And continually questions that idea of giving them titles.
Okay. Anything else? You've got passages that make distinctions while emphasizing unity. You think of Ephesians 4, 1 Corinthians, that talk about, you know, the different kinds of gifts that people have, but how they all work together and they're all essential, and one doesn't say to the other, I don't need you, or, you know, you're far superior than I am. You might think of, you know, 1 Corinthians 1, I am of Peter, I am of Paul, I am of Apollos, and that's the kind of thinking that comes from elevating an individual above everyone else. And you're not going to have a clear-cut passage. And the problem is, what we want is a clear-cut passage where we can say, aha, look at this verse, thou shalt not call anyone reverend. That's what we want. That verse doesn't exist. And so you have to think about it in different kinds of contexts and other kinds of verses. You find verses that talk about unity and equality, and that's what you're looking for. And this verse just doesn't do that duty.
I have written here an adjective to inspire reverence.
Okay. Yeah, it makes us understand the character of God. And, you know, just like we fear God, there are people that we are to fear as well. And the Bible tells us that, you know, in various places. But we don't fear people the same way we fear God. And that goes back to what Shane was saying earlier. That it's a different level, a different degree of fear. Yes, sir?
3 John 9 gives us an example of someone who saw the biography wanting to be first.
Yeah.
And he was condemned by John.
Okay. So there's another verse that we might kind of add in with the ones where we, you know, we're making an argument against that kind of self-boasting and self-elevating, or even if it's not self, like Diotrephes, you know, elevating another person into a place that they don't have the right to have. Shane?
Well, I think the ultimate one was Jesus himself when he was talking to his disciples the night that he was crucified. And he said, if you want to be first, you need to be last.
Yeah.
I mean, this is everything that you thought has turned on its ear, because if you want to be a master, you actually need to be a servant.
Yeah.
And so There's no room for someone, if they wanted to elevate themselves as a pious individual, then accepting a title and being of a title should be the exact opposite of what that person would want to do.
Right, and that's, I mean, you see that even displayed in what Jesus does that night. He, you know, we're told in John 13, he knew that his time had come, and he knew who he was, and he knew he was going back to the Father. And that's a pretty significant, you know, mental context for him. He knows that he's God and he's going to God. So what does he do in the context of that awareness? He takes a towel and washes people's feet. You know, that's the mentality that we're talking about. All right, one more, then we need to move on. Barry.
Given that title, right. Have a right carry that title, and that's hard to argue against when you know that whole belief is based on, hey, I went to school for this. You know, this is I went to get that particular title.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing to think about, how to argue with someone that has gone through that track for that purpose. Right. All right, we'll jump back to number three because there's no rhyme or reason to what I'm doing. And I want to talk about this one, and we're about to run out of time. That's the rhyme or reason. Number three, in Romans 8:28, we read that all things work together for good to them that love God. Some conclude this means that only good things happen to God's people, but why is this view wrong?
All things includes good and bad.
Okay. Okay.
Joseph had a lot of bad things that happened, but God meant it for good, as he interprets at the end of his, you know, at the conclusion, he said it was all bad, and you meant it for bad, but God used it for good.
So we might have what we would call anecdotal evidence. You look at people who endured bad things, who were lovers of God that God loved. You know, we could look around our lives and say, well, bad things happen to me, and the answer might be, well, maybe God doesn't love you, or you don't love God. Well, no, that's not the point. I mean, obviously. But you look at David, you look at Joseph, you look at Jesus, you look at Paul, you have plenty of evidence that bad things happen to those that love God. So that's kind of the first level, I think, of thinking about it, is that kind of anecdotal evidence that it happens. Go ahead, Shane. Okay.
You know, we're going to be chastised by God. And that's not a good thing. What we would perceive as human in this world, we wouldn't perceive those things that we're going through as good things. We would perceive them as bad things, most likely, as God, you know, tries to urge us or nudge us back in the right direction.
Okay. So there's different kinds of bad things that happen, and some of that is heavenly discipline, we might call it, which doesn't, you know, isn't pleasant at the time, but it produces good results, as Hebrews tells us. Charlie, a glass?
You are correct.
Okay, Greg?
Yeah, his scripture, we're told, forgive 7 times 7, you turn the cheek, go 1 mile, go to the 23rd Psalm, and the mountain valley, be with death, he's with you. All the good God will move the person. I mean, the Bible tells you.
Yeah, that's an interesting point on Psalm 23. Notice, you know, he doesn't say, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want, therefore I will never walk through the shadow of death. There is no evil. There are no enemies. You'll walk with me through the valley of death. You know, there is no evil to fear. My table is prepared in the presence of my enemies. And there's that kind of shadow of a lament basically running all the way through Psalm 23. But the answer is, because God is a shepherd, he doesn't have to worry about those things in that same kind of way. So there's an implication there as well. Jeremy?
Well, two things. One is that to add to that list of righteous people who have suffered, it's the church that Paul's talking to. I mean, the reason he says all things work together for good is because they're being persecuted and they're not, you know, and he's encouraging them in their grief. So that's number one. But number two, I think this passage is really instructive to me, and because, you know, we look at that all things work together for good, and I just insert whatever I want in there, like, okay, I'm going to get a nice car and a nice house.
It's all things work together for my good, as I understand good, is kind of the way we read it.
But if you listen, God is telling you what is good, and in the very next verse he says, to be conformed to the image of his son.
Right.
That's what's good. That's the good that is the goal of our life, and that all things are working together for. It's not my temporal, earthly happiness.
And so there's the good that is defined here. And then in addition to that, if you look at the larger context, notice verse 18, for I consider that we will never suffer because we are Christians. No, I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed within us. Verse 22, we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now. And not only the creation, but we ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for adoption as sons, the redemptions of our body. Verse 26, likewise the Spirit helps us in our weakness, for we do not know what to pray for as we ought, but the Spirit Himself intercedes for us with groanings too deep for words. Verse 35, who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Well, we don't have to worry about tribulation or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness or danger or sword, because all things work together for good. No, there are these things that are realities that will not separate us from the love of Christ. And so you've got this entire surrounding context that talks repeatedly of suffering. And it's in the middle of that that he says all things work together for good. And so it cannot be this, you know, Pollyanna, Hollywood, happily ever after, dancing on rainbows kind of everything's going to be happy-go-lucky for the rest of my life. That's not what this verse means, and we ignore the context of the passage, we ignore the context of the epistle, we ignore the context of Paul's life, we ignore the context of the Bible if we try to interpret it that way. And we'll leave on that point. I'll leave you with what did we not talk about? 4, 7, and 8 to think about more on your own. And Tom will be back on Wednesday to pick up where he left off.